Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to spend the next hour together figuring out what happened this week and why it matters. And we're lucky to have Ijeoma Oluo, editor of The Establishment, author of the forthcoming book, So You Want to Talk About Race. Yes, I do. And we will. Okay. Welcome. Q13 News political analyst, C.R. Douglas. Hi.
Hello. No book coming out, unfortunately.
Well, when you do, the answer will be yes. I do want to talk about that.
Amen.
Whatever your topic is. Stranger reporter Sydney Brownstone, welcome back.
Hello.
And we're all on Twitter at, well, KOW is at KOW, and we'll hook you up with all the handles of my esteemed guests. Let's get right at it. The top story this week, when Houston was hit by a hurricane, the nation mostly focused on people, people trapped, people flooded out of their homes, dozens of deaths so far at least. Mixed in with that empathy were some observations that may or may not have qualified as victim blaming. First of all, Houston is the capital of the world's petroleum industry, which is ironic as we associate climate change with strong storms. The New York Times called Houston perhaps America's purest model of untrammeled growth, built on, among other things, the glories of air conditioning and a fierce aversion to regulation. On NPR, Bloomberg reporter Peter Coy talked about his piece called Harvey Wasn't Just Bad Weather, It Was Bad City Planning.
Flooding, which has always been endemic to Houston, has been getting worse. More and more of the land is paved over. So when rain hits, you already have a clay-like soil, which doesn't retain water well. And now it comes flushing off all the pavement and concrete and so on. And it just goes right into the streets. The streets fill up with water. And then, as we see now, in a severe flooding, the whole city fills up.
Is it appropriate to make these points as people are still stranded and homeless and maybe dying? That Bloomberg reporter says he made some readers mad.
I got an email from a reader who said that he actually agreed with the point of the story. He just felt like it was a little too soon when they're still finding bodies, still doing search and rescue. And the last thing they want is any kind of news coverage that seems to be blaming the victims.
My panel, do any of you think you're a terrible person if you privately appreciate the irony of anti-government, pro-business, overbuilding, Trump-voting Texans and others paying for sins and calling for government help?
I don't think anyone's rejoicing in people being flooded out by Hurricane Harvey. And if you are, I think I can say you're a bad person.
Rejoicing is strong.
Yes, but I do think it is appropriate. And I think it's good to point out where poor urban design and climate denialism continues to contribute to the crisis. Texas was one of the states that sued the EPA over Obama's Clean Power Plan. And part of the reason why so many of our cities aren't prepared for extreme weather events like this is because they refuse to deal with climate science. So I don't think it's victim blaming here. The only victim is climate denialism and poor design.
By the way, according to the International Business Times, the company that owns the chemical plant spewing noxious smoke got, no surprise, federal regulators to delay new rules to improve safety procedures at chemical plants. Others?
I think it's a little too early to know exactly what contributed to this devastation. Maybe it's design. Maybe it's some of the building codes there. But if you have an earthquake in our region, I guarantee you, a big enough one, there'll be things that come down and there'll be a lot of second guessing about should our earthquake protections have been stronger? Should we have done more?
We have been warned.
We have been warned and we do a lot of things, but I'm sure it's not enough. It's never enough. There's only so much you can do rationally to prepare for once in 100 or once in 500 year storm. Again, we'll know more about what Houston could have done reasonably, but every time you spend a ton of money preparing for something, it's not going to something else.
Okay. Some in the media, though, went beyond those notes about regulation. Did you see the political cartoons? Politico had the rednecks with Confederate flags and anti-government flags looking up at the rescue helicopters saying, "Angel sent by God," and the rescuer saying, "Actually, a Coast Guard sent by the government." Too soon?
You know, I think that we have to remember that the people who are going to be most devastatingly impacted by these events are the people who honestly have the least amount of socioeconomic power in our society. And I, in no way, would ever rejoice for that. That this, it's not as if we just have a bunch of people who are like, yeah, you know, I don't care about the environment. Oh, no, what's happening? We do have that in every population, but I think it's really important to not just stereotype. I think we like to like write this off as just like this, you know, backwards Southern problem. But the truth is we all contribute to climate change. We all have that blood on our hands. Even if we say we believe in climate change, even if we say that we want changes, we are still consuming. We still have a large carbon footprint, and we do bear some of that responsibility. I think we need to look at where we have failed people, and I do say a collective we, where we have failed to prepare, where, you know, our environmental policies are setting up to increase the frequency of these events. And we need to look at what we can do to make sure that as these continue to happen, and it's going to happen with more and more frequency, that we are doing what we can to, you know, minimize the impact on our most vulnerable populations and really try to make sure that we're not setting up entire populations who don't have an option to just move for more disaster.
Just to shout out a little bit for the first responders and for the response in general, it's been pretty good. I mean, if you compare this to Katrina, which is kind of the obvious comparison people are making, you had 1,800 people die in Katrina. So far, you've had 36. Now, that number will go up a little bit. You had well over 100,000 evacuated after Katrina. You've had much fewer here. I mean, this has been a more contained disaster, and partly that is because of a lot of lessons we learned after Katrina. FEMA has gotten much better. State and local governments have gotten much better. The private sector has gotten much better. I mean, remember, one of the big issues in Katrina was all phones went out. I mean, you couldn't call anyone, people needing help, all that kind of stuff. The telecoms have much better infrastructure now along the Gulf Coast than they ever did. So lots of calls got through. Not all, but most calls got through. I mean, that saved who knows how many lives and injuries. So things are better because we did learn and we do improve in these situations.
Speaking of lessons learned, just to echo Ijoma's point, we've learned from disasters like Katrina, and we've learned from climate reports from the IPCC that the people who are going to be most impacted are the poorest. And Houston itself is an incredibly diverse city. It's only 50% white, and 23% of the population is African American. So, you know, it doesn't matter what your political beliefs are. We know that in these types of disasters, the people hit are going to have the least resources to recover.
And in case you care, Houston didn't vote for Trump, just Texas. So unlike the comment sections of websites, none of you have Schadenfreude about. Did you see the Charlie Hebdo cartoon? The Nazi flags and Sieg Heil saluting hands sticking up out of floodwaters, and it says, God exists. He drowned all the neo-Nazis of Texas.
They really missed the point. And also, I hope they know that, you know, there are a lot of Trump voters in the Seattle suburbs too. Like, they're not exclusive to the state of Texas.
And it was basically kind of a ridiculous cover story, the sort of Nazis drowning. First of all, there's not really even an association with Houston specifically and neo-Nazis, right? The most recent, like, sighting and location of neo-Nazis was Charlottesville. So if a storm had
what if it had been in a redder part of Texas?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it would have made thematic sense. I still think it would have been an absurd cartoon. I mean, this is not payback for any political ideology.
Yeah. By the way, I saw of course, this is what kids will do. How does this affect me? And I'm a child myself, right? So I said, she wanted to know about, are we, you know, is it going to flood here? Do we have hurricanes here? So we talked about that, and then I Googled it and found this New York Times kind of digest of the crunching numbers, and finding that of the top most safe American cities when it comes to natural disasters, it was Corvallis, Anacortes, Bellingham, Wenatchee, Spokane, Salem, Seattle, Yakima, Olympia. I think there was one Colorado town in there, but... But if you, one thing that could enable your smugness, none of you, but some people's smugness, is the idea that we don't, unless you live in a floodplain here, you could judge Houston for building a city on the swamp. Why do you live there?
I think it's important to remember that in our little, you know, liberal safe haven, it's incredibly expensive to live here. We live here because we can afford to live here. And a lot of people can't afford to live elsewhere. I know plenty of people who are really stuck in the only places they can afford to live. And sometimes those are going to be very red states. Those are going to be states that don't, you know, mesh with any of your own personal beliefs. And you're not going to have an option to move. You can't move your kids. You can't move your job. This is a city where only, you know, very select few can actually make it. And if you live here and you don't have the resources, you're just as vulnerable to disaster as anyone else. And I think we really do have to remember that there are a lot of people who live all across the country for various different reasons, for family, for job, and many, many people simply would never be able to afford to live in a place like this. We can joke and laugh about how we live in the right place, but the amount of privilege it takes to be able to live here and comfortably say that you feel safe here is astounding. And I think we need to be aware of that.
And yet, the risks are greater than that list suggests. I mean, the big thing that can happen to us is not a hurricane, a tornado, a monsoon, but an earthquake. And don't forget, by the way, we have 5 active volcanoes in this state. We have wildfires. We do have floods, as you say. We have mudslides. So we're not out of the woods. And though earthquakes happen much less frequently than like hurricanes in the Gulf, when they do happen, they usually make up for their infrequency by their devastation. We discovered not that many years ago a huge new fault called the Seattle Fault that literally lies right under the city, sort of along that I-90 corridor going from Bainbridge through Seattle out east. And if that disrupts, and at one point it will, there will be devastation, tsunamis, all the rest.
That's C.R. Douglas with Sidney Brownstone and Ijeoma Oluo. Coming up on the Week in Review, labeling Antifa a criminal gang and alien fish swimming and spreading and not being able to eat, as you'll find out. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. This week, the mayor of Berkeley, California, said anti-fascist groups like Antifa and Black Bloc should be labeled criminal gangs. Right-wing rallies and counter-rallies got violent in Berkeley. Mayor Jesse Aragin said he has no sympathy for neo-Nazis, but the left-wing groups are going too far.
I think we're going to have to think big picture about what's the strategy of how we're going to deal with these violent elements on the left as well.
The mayor said it was also time for nonviolent protesters to take a stand as well.
We also need to hold accountable and encourage people not to associate with these extremists because it empowers them and it gives them cover.
Are groups like Antifa being effective when they get violent? I spoke this week with University of Washington History Assistant Professor Lori Marhofer, who studied the rise of the German Nazis.
One of the key steps in the building of the Nazi dictatorship was that the Nazis fomented violence in the streets by provoking leftists, got into street fights with them, let those street fights be portrayed in the media, and then turned around and portrayed themselves as victims of left-wing violence and claimed that they needed emergency police powers to put down the violence left. And they were
and restore law and order.
Exactly. And restore law and order. So the Reichstag fire decree was simply Hitler saying, we need to put down the communists and we need to suspend the Constitution to do that.
Professor Marhofer said, when you get violent, you're giving right wingers what they want.
So what the Nazis did was to organize rallies and marches in communist neighborhoods on purpose. And we have documents from the Nazi Party that show that they did this on purpose to provoke the communists to violence. And I do think that the people who organized the rallies that we've seen recently in Charlottesville, the recent Berkeley rally, did that on purpose to provoke especially the Antifa to violence. And I'm very, very worried about what could happen on the national level about that, about the way that violence is perceived, and then how people who are friendly towards authoritarianism could make use of that perception.
Ijeoma Oluo, are you prepared to condemn Antifa violence?
No, No. I am a nonviolent person. I do not engage in violence. But I think that the entire discussion is a distraction. It's a purposeful distraction. You know, when we talk about like what the aims of these groups are and whether or not they want to foment violence, a lot of what they are depending on is our skewed priorities and how we define violence. There is violence already. White supremacists and people wearing swastika armbands marching through the streets is violence. But we don't.
Well, I don't think this Nazi studying professor would disagree with that.
Yeah. But I think that as a society, we don't see it as violence. We see it as speech. We see it maybe as hateful. We don't see it as violence. We don't see it as something that actually traumatizes people and makes them unsafe and harms people. It already is violence. But because we prioritize one over the other, and because the populations being impacted are already marginalized populations that the general public honestly doesn't prioritize, we are going to all of a sudden prioritize violence against these incredibly violent people. And I think that what we end up with is the goal of these groups is to make people of color, to make Jewish people, to make queer people, to make trans people feel unsafe. It's to gain power by building themselves up as above these other people and to flex that power and make other people feel scared and feel hurt and feel unsafe. And so we have the primary victims of this being completely pushed aside. And now the debate is whether or not this group of leftist, predominantly white men are the bad guys or whether this group of, you know, racist, hate-mongering white men are the bad guys. And the people who are in the crosshairs of this entire thing aren't even talked about. Why aren't we focused more on what we can do to make people of color, to make our Jewish populations and our queer populations and our trans populations feel safe as they are being attacked over and over and over again?
Ijeomi, you're saying their goal is to make marginalized people feel unsafe. This history professor is saying their goal, or at least a goal, is to provoke and draw their opponents in to violence and don't let it work. Is there a disagreement there?
I think that part of the reason why they are doing that is because they know that in general, people just care less about the lives of minority populations. And what they're going to see when they see another white person getting attacked is, oh, now it's a problem. Now this is a serious issue. And I think that if we want to look at this and look at what happened in the past and learn from it, the lesson to learn is not don't be aggressive in fighting back against hate, but instead, as a society, be more aggressive in recognizing where the real hate really is and where the violence really is. And as a society...
How about both? How about be aggressive in one way, but not this way, this professor is saying?
I think that if you want to get out in the street and not and be less aggressive and but still fight, do that. But I think that this debate, oftentimes what happens is people say, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. Okay, you go and do it right. You do it right. And when that becomes more effective, more people will do it.
But, instead of doing nothing but saying you're doing it wrong.
Exactly.
Okay, others?
I'm Jewish. I've never really bought into the turn the other cheek thing. I think I have a more Talmudic sense of justice where if you're going to come for me and my family, I have a right to defend myself. But so I don't have a problem with punching Nazis on moral grounds.
Yeah.
However, in terms of strategy, I saw the Berkeley video and my first thought was, oh, man, this is a severe optics problem.
Which Berkeley video?
This was a video posted by Shane Bauer. There was a confrontation between Antifa and I believe someone who was part of the Oath Keepers group. And the video shows this group of Antifa kind of attacking this guy and actually a black journalist intervening and protecting the Oath Keepers dude. From
Al Letson, the host of Reveal, who I interviewed, and you can find that at our website, too. Yes,
yeah.
I talked to him this week about this.
Yes, and Al, for the record, said that he is worried about this type of violence creating a sense of false equivalency and that the march was mostly peaceful, which is important to not lose sight of.
Right.
But so I started interrogating this idea of an optics problem to myself more, and I kind of want to challenge that because if a person watches that video and feels sorry for Nazis as well as their ideology, they're a Nazi sympathizer. There's a big jump between feeling sorry for a guy who gets punched in the face and then sympathizing with the idea of a white ethnostate. So when we say that this is a problem strategically, what are we actually referring to? Is this a problem for would-be resistors of the Trump regime who would show up to a protest except they feel sorry for Nazis? I don't actually know anyone like that. I'm curious, like, does anyone else know anyone like that? And if you're someone who sympathizes with the ideology of a white ethnostate, I don't really want you on my team anyway.
I agree with the sentiments of the Berkeley mayor and the professor you interviewed, which is that violence is the wrong approach. It's the moral low ground. What we learn from the civil rights movement, from Martin Luther King, who borrowed it from Gandhi, is that the beauty of nonviolence is so powerful. And the beauty of confronting even violent folks with nonviolence and your moral high ground is what changed America. That is what was behind Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. You're not going to gain anything by punching a neo-Nazi. Now, I'm not talking about self-defense. I'm just talking proactively. Some of these antifas are proactively punching, right? That's just...
But we're kind of talking about what is self-defense, you know?
Well...
That a neo-Nazi is inherently violent. That's the idea.
I don't even disagree this concept that you can interpret the kind of state as sort of violent in some way if it is oppressive of people. But when I'm talking just active street violence, this is what we're talking about, encountering people on the street, the power, look at Selma. Look at the power of those marches in Selma. They were about walking into violence. I mean, authority of the state, police, banging people, using baton, John Lewis getting hit, you know, and yet continuing to go and being nonviolent. That is how you change the minds. I mean, these neo-Nazis, like it or not, they're ours. They grew up in America. Somehow they got created here, right? And they weren't imported from anywhere else. And we got to figure out how to get that out of our culture and our system. And it's not just punching them back.
I think it's important to remember, I mean, because this is definitely something I would say as a Black writer comes up a lot. I will talk about activism and King is always brought up. And I think it's important to remember first that King was shot in the head. You know, it wasn't like, oh, he was peaceful and then everything worked out well. He was viewed as violent. His marches were viewed as violent. The discussions we're having right now about Antifa are nothing compared to the discussions that were had around King. And for all of this talk about how effective it was, the truth is that if you look at the fact that we live in a country where 1 in 3 Black men is in prison, we can't say that this all had a rosy ending. We can't say that nonviolence is the only way when, you know, for 300 years, 400 years, we have been fighting for equality and we are nowhere near there. And I think that we have to stop putting the onus on the oppressed and the threatened to continue to take abuse and turn the other cheek and say that's the only way to move forward. We've been saying that for hundreds and hundreds of years. And really, the truth is that what we need is everyone who's doing nothing to do something. And that's really where I want that discussion to lie. I don't want it to lie in, are the people who are doing something doing the right things? I want the people who are doing nothing, and that is the vast majority of people, to do something. Because if there's anything we can learn from King, we can learn that you can dedicate your entire life and you can die for this. And 50 years later, we can be in almost the exact same position because people will use it. They will put it on cards. They will make a holiday, but they will not get in the streets. They will not fight back. Everyday citizens won't do what is necessary to actually fight this evil that is white supremacy in this country. And we have an opportunity right now to be making a difference. And instead, we are equivocating over whether or not the actions of some of the few people who are out there at least trying to make these people feel a little less secure and safe in their hate, we're arguing whether or not they're doing it the right way. And what I would love to learn from King is that we all need to dedicate our lives, that one person dedicating his life, that even one group of people dedicating their lives to this is not enough. And it's the people who aren't impacted, the people who feel safe, the people who feel like they can even have this debate as to whether or not fighting back is okay. That's not a debate I get to have. It's not a debate Sydney gets to have, because we are the people in the crosshairs of this. I only need the people who feel comfortable having this debate to feel uncomfortable and feel like they have no choice but to act. And that's what I would like people to learn from our history of activism in this country, is that it is never enough. It is never enough to expect those in the crosshairs to be the only ones standing up. It is never enough to expect them to always turn the other cheek, and that we all need to feel harmed. We all need to feel threatened. We all need to feel angry and filled with righteous love for our neighbors who are being hurt, and act.
Yeah, so Ijeoma's not advocating street violence. She's using this moment instead to talk about passivity and obliviousness.
And I don't think any, I certainly wouldn't agree with that. I mean, more people need to be engaged, and more people need to do things to fight injustice. But I would disagree that King didn't make a difference, or we're in the same place we were 50 years ago. I mean, that's just wrong, I think. We've made huge progress. Are we there? No. Do we have more fights to wage? Absolutely. But we are in a phenomenally better place than we were 50 years ago because of the civil rights movement, because of what Martin Luther King did, and because of the millions he inspired to follow him.
I think that nonviolence is an excellent strategy, but I also think that having the conversation about whether Antifa is violent or destroying our movements is playing directly into the false equivalency that Trump has created. And I would agree with Ijeoma that my bigger fear is apathy, or the fear that many well-meaning white people have of being viewed as impolite. And I keep returning to this Primo Levi quote, which I think I've said on the program before, that monsters exist, but they are too few in number to be truly dangerous. More dangerous are the common men, the functionaries ready to believe and to act without asking questions.
Do you think that's especially appropriate in Seattle?
I think that it's appropriate everywhere, because I think that national politics trickles down to the local politics. It trickles down to city councils in the suburbs across the country. And people who are willing to deputize local law enforcement to do immigration sweeps, who just say that they're following orders, I see some historical parallels here. And why are we on this program talking about a group of white dudes punching another white dude when ICE is separating families and you know, detaining people for months because they crossed the border?
Is Antifa all white dudes?
I don't. It would be inaccurate to say that they're all white dudes. I'm referring to the video we saw in Berkeley, and it's problematic to assume that they were white because their faces were covered, and obviously I don't know what their ethnicities are. But I do think that there is a problem on the left of weaponizing white male rage, and you can see that in Antifa and in marches sometimes. And it's a conversation that we should have, but not right now, not when we're trying to deal with white supremacy. I don't think these are issues to be discussed in the same breath.
Okay, let's pause there. That's Sydney Brownstone, Stranger Reporter. We are with Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas. Ijeoma Oluo is the author of the forthcoming book, So You Want to Talk About Race. I think we do, actually. And she's the editor of The Establishment as well. And we're on Week in Review, and we're coming back to talk about government-paid college tuition and the big fish spill. So stay tuned. I'm Bill Radke, bringing you the Week in Review here on the radio and on Twitter at KUOW. Free college tuition for Seattle. That was the campaign proposal this week from one of Seattle's two mayoral candidates, Jenny Durkin. She wants to offer all public high school graduates 2 years of free community college, CR. How would she pay for this?
Well, she has said she'd try to tap about three different sources, one of which is the recently passed soda tax, which will raise next year about $15 million. So that's certainly a pot to go for.
Wasn't that supposed to go toward public health?
I think it was partly supposed to go to public health and education, but she'll be the new mayor, assuming, you know, she gets an ability to even implement this idea. If she is elected, she has the power to, you know, redirect that money or certainly push for its redirection. She's also talked about the families and education levy, which is up for renewal next year. And that's probably what, well over $300 million they're expecting as a possible source. You know,
which again is, I mean, isn't that earmarked for K through 12?
No, not necessarily. Oh. No. And it can be, you know, every time it's up for renewal, they have sort of a new program they come up with. It's not just an automatic set of issues. There's always different priorities every time you see it in front of voters. I was surprised at how little this costs. I mean, when I first saw this headline, free college tuition, I thought, wow, okay, she's biting off a lot. But the numbers they're putting out are $6-7 million a year. You know, in a multi-billion-dollar city budget, that's pretty achievable if you want to do it.
Her opponent's response to this, Carrie Moon, was basically, yes, free tuition, but Durkin's approach is not enough, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly a play at trying to get more progressives in their camp. You know, I mean, Durkin is kind of the mainstream establishment candidate, if you will. There were about five sort of progressives on the left, if you will. Carrie Moon sort of rose, and so it's the two of them now. And for Durkin to kind of win this thing, she needs to make some inroads into the progressive community. She doesn't need to win it, but she needs to make some inroads. And here's an idea that puts a stake in progressive turf. I mean, listen, what was the most popular idea Bernie Sanders last fall? It was free college tuition. So she pulls from that playbook and says, hey, we're going to do that. And it'll win some support.
But what Carrie Moon means by not enough is she wants to raise new money, right? Where Jenny Durkin's saying, we'll pay for it with what we have.
I don't think it's clear what Carrie Moon. I think Carrie Moon was sort of taken by surprise with this. And it's kind of like, you know, she was a bit contorted about how to respond. Because obviously it's not something Carrie Moon's going to say, this is a bad idea.
But she said we rather than being revenue neutral, the old revenue neutral thing, you know, if we can all agree on something we want, that's an opportunity from her point of view to raise more progressive taxes.
I guarantee you, as we go on, this is going to be something Carrie Moon is just going to accept. I mean, you're not going to have a lot of debate over whether free college tuition is a good idea in this campaign. They will both agree on it.
Yeah, I mean, I get the feeling that in this case, Jenny Durkin kind of stole Carrie Moon's lunch. And I remember being on this program a week ago, and I was saying that Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin going into the general are going to have to move towards more progressive policies in order to pick up Seattle voters. And Rob McKenna was saying, no,
He said they had to pivot toward the middle. Campaigns work.
Toward the middle. But I'm actually really excited to see this because I think the Democratic Party could learn a lesson or two that you actually need to offer people something. And here is Jenny Durkin offering a policy, a progressive policy. I think that Carrie Moon is right to point out that just because Durkin is offering this progressive policy does not mean that she has a progressive worldview. And so I think that'll be fleshed out in debates going up to the mayoral primary.
You're not saying she's not progressive. Sure. You're just saying we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm excited because I hope this turns into a battle of ideas and progressive policies. And I hope that the People's Party and Nikita's campaign is able to leverage their endorsement power to maybe help Carrie Moon develop some of the ideas that they put forward that got a lot of voters excited.
I went on vacation. Did Nikita Oliver endorse Carrie Moon?
She
hadn't when I interviewed her before I left.
The latest I heard was she said she will vote for Carrie Moon.
Yeah, that's what she told me.
But that the People's Party will probably not make an endorsement. But within that, she's also been pretty critical of Carrie Moon. I mean, she said, you know, here's a white woman of privilege who pretty, you know, largely self-funded her campaign. You know, I'm not sure she's going to be, the right carrier of this People's Party flame.
Ijeoma Luo, you excited about free college tuition for us? This is for graduates of all Seattle public high schools.
And they get 1 year free college tuition. In a Seattle, any state or community college in the state.
A two-year college, not a four-year college.
Right.
There you go. Do you care?
I mean, I care. I think that it's a good step, but I would honestly like to see more focus on improving our K-12 education. You know, Seattle's has some serious issues and inequalities in their school system that I would like to see addressed to have our students better prepared to take advantage of community college. We already have options like Running Start and things like that that students are taking advantage of. But the truth is that we are, you know, we're falling short in preparing our young people even through high school to even go to college. And I would love to see more focus there. But, you know, I'm not going to like say no free college. I think that any parent who's getting ready, and I have a 16-year-old, to send their kids off to college is wondering how they're going to afford it. But I also think there are a lot of young people who are lost far before that discussion is even had. And I mean, it's no secret that we aren't funding our education enough and that we are lacking resources in Seattle public schools. And I would love to see more focus going to that. But I think that financially, strategically, that's a lot more complicated. And that may not be a conversation that Durkin's ready to have.
CR, finally, parents, whatever your politics are, you might wonder, is this free community college thing actually going to happen? Is this a slam dunk, whoever becomes mayor?
I don't think it's a slam dunk, but, and let me correct myself, I believe this is this would be 2 years.
I think it's 2 years.
Yeah, right now we actually there is a pilot program in Seattle, in Southeast Seattle, I think it's 4 high schools, where you can get 1 year of free college, community college tuition. Okay. So this would roll that out citywide and also would add the second year and be for any community college in the state, is her current plan. I think this is very doable if whoever gets elected. Again, I expect Carrie Moon to support this. I just think $7 million, if that really is the price tag, is a very achievable number. I mean,
why hasn't it already happened if it's so unanimously popular?
That's a good question, but it actually is happening. I mean, we have had this pilot program, and there is some energy around it. I think Mayor Murray was getting ready to do something big like this. So it's been in the works, I would say. It's not just an idea that Jenny Durkin dreamt up yesterday.
Okay, Jenny Durkin proposing 2 years of free community college for Seattle Public School graduates, including undocumented students, by the way. Carrie Moon agrees. They just disagree on how to pay for it. We're disagreeing on what to do about all these freaky fishies from the other ocean swimming around here. They got released. It turns out not because of a solar eclipse. We're going to tell you all about that and talk about whether Seattle's a company town and whether that's a bad thing as we continue on The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with the editor of The Establishment, Ijeoma Oluo, and from Q13 News, political analyst C.R. Douglas, from The Stranger, reporter Sydney Brownstone. This week, we've been watching our precious native salmon stocks being invaded by aliens. Earlier this month, hundreds of thousands of farmed Atlantic salmon escaped from a pen near the San Juan Islands. They escaped because their net broke. Washington Fish and Wildlife Department official Ron Warren at first told KUOW, blame it on the heavens.
Our understanding is with the solar eclipse came some pretty severe tidal exchanges, and within the San Juan Island structure themselves, those currents are pretty strong at times.
It wasn't the eclipse. Here is our KUOW investigative reporter, John Ryan.
We found that the state has known for more than 6 months that this fish farm is in really bad shape with corrosion and metal fatigue, and it's really on its last legs. But even so, the state agreed to the company's proposal to put the full load of 3 million pounds of salmon in the thing, and that is one big factor behind why it collapsed.
John Ryan did some good work on this. We're going to tweet out a link to that at KUOW. So anyway, these invasive species fish have spread across the Sound and through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. You say Juan de Fuca or Juan de Fuca?
I say the latter.
Yeah. I say Juan de Fuca until I...
Does someone correct you?
I have a voice in my head. I have two voices in my head. One of them is a salmon.
That's dangerous.
So they go through the strait, and they've been out to the coast, and they've gone up to British Columbia. And the worry is that these Atlantic farm fish are going to hurt our native wild salmon, eat their food and eat their babies and bring disease and waste and parasites that our local fish can't handle. Though we don't know that's happening. For one thing, KUOW's John Ryan told us these farmed fish literally wouldn't hurt a fly.
One bit of good news for wild salmon. So far, the 10-pound predators from another part of the planet don't appear to be eating anything. Their stomachs have been empty when they're caught.
They don't know how to eat. They just, unless you're throwing fishy pellets at them.
That's the problem. It's like a domesticated animal. You put them out in the wild and forget it. They're the first to be lunch of a coyote.
So that's part of the concern as well. How worried should we be about these can't feed themselves fish? But the fact is they could do damage. Washington State has, first of all, declared open season. Please go fish. Go catch all these Atlantic salmon that you can. The state has banned any new fish farms until they review the situation. Some people are calling for the industry to be shut down here completely. The thing is, not only is this not the first fish farm escape, there have been many accidental releases. Our state has purposely put Atlantic salmon into local waters many times. For decades, they tried to establish Atlantic runs here, and they never took hold. So, Sydney, how upset should we be?
I think we should take a cue from the people whose livelihoods and cultures depend on wild salmon runs. And so the Lummi Nation, for example, has declared a state of emergency over this. I don't work with salmon, so I don't claim to be a fish biologist. I don't know what's up. I do know that they're an invasive species, and we should be concerned about you know, 300,000 of them suddenly in our streams. And I think we should treat this like an oil spill. We should treat this like it's any unintended consequence of, you know, human growth in our economy. It's not just about salmon, right? It's about people's lives, and specifically it's about treaty rights and respecting tribes who rely on wild salmon runs for survival.
Dozens of Indian tribes are calling for the fish farm industry to be shut down around here. As you say, their fisheries are protected, and they know something about invasive species from the Atlantic. What do you think? What do you make of this, all this? You've watched the fish swim and not eat, CR?
Well, it's been a learning experience. I didn't realize this was an issue until it became an issue. So then you have to learn about it and figure out what's the right answer.
Did you know Washington State is the leading farmed Atlantic salmon producer in America? And California and Alaska ban the industry, and there are no Atlantic salmon farms operating in Oregon. I didn't know that till I knew there was a problem, but I didn't. I read that in the Seattle Times. I didn't realize all that.
Yeah, and I was wondering if they meant no open farms in open waters, or actually any farms at all in these other states. Something for listeners to check. What's unlikely is to shut down the industry. I think there'll be new regulations and new rules, and we ought to be concerned about this happening. But the fact is, folks, we eat a lot of salmon. And the reason we have salmon farms is because it is easier to sort of, you know, beef up and bulk up salmon quicker and better in these farms. I wonder, you know, what the heck are Atlantic salmon doing in the Pacific anyway? And the answer is because you can domesticate Atlantic salmon much, much more easily than Pacific salmon, which is why we have them around here. But if you shut down the industry, you're going to shut down, you know, a lot of food service, a lot of salmon services and restaurants. It would be a big problem.
See, the Atlantic salmon can be domesticated. This is another reason to be smug about having our fiercely independent salmon. Does this feel a little xenophobic to you? This is a Seattle Times editorial I quote from. Wild salmon remains superior, especially to those raised in a culture that reveres the greatness and flavor of our iconic native species.
You know, if we...
No offense, Seattle Times. I just have that...
It's a bit over the top.
Freaky feeling.
It's a bit over the top. Yeah. But I would say, honestly, if we revered salmon as much as we say we do, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in right now. We would have had much better land management and fish management for many, many years. The truth is the people who do revere salmon are the people right now who are, you know, most at risk from our hubris and our, frankly, laziness in not wanting to find an actual lasting and responsible solution to our decline in fish populations. I think that it
isn't farming. Yeah, it doesn't work. There's releases. I mean, I don't know. But yeah, that's the idea. CR said people want to eat, and fish are good for you, and farming makes them cheaper and more available. That's the idea.
But we don't want to be responsible about it. You know, and that's the thing I think we have to remember. The worst case scenario always happens. And I think that especially when we look at things where, you know, populations that require, you know, that are going to be the first impacted when the worst case scenario happens are almost always our more marginalized population. When we look at like the Lummi Nation and our other indigenous people in the area who require, you know, actual native fish, we are willing to gamble with that. Everyone knew what the risk was going in. And the truth is the worst case scenario always happens. And I think we can even look at, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline. The worst case scenario will happen there. It will happen anywhere else that we decide that we're going to put the risk on our marginalized populations. We know the risk is there. We've seen from history the worst case scenario always happens sooner or later. And then we go, oh no, what are we going to do? Oh, it's too late. We're too invested. I think we should act like we're going to shut down the fisheries. We're not. We're not. There's too many jobs. But I think we should act like it, because one day we will have to. The disaster will be too big, and we need to be putting in place other situations. You know, we need to start looking at what we can do to really shore up the native population of fish and make sure that we are, you know, minimizing the impact of this. But I think a lesson to learn here is it always happens. The worst case scenario, when we start messing around with these things, when we're doing things that we know can have a real negative impact on nature and our environment, the worst case scenario always happens.
And you're saying if the victims were wealthy, then the state would be having more and better rules and spending more money on making sure it doesn't happen.
Oh, yeah. If we had every comfortable Seattleite demanded fresh salmon and the people that were profiting off of it were these mid-Seattle companies, oh my goodness, people would be taken to the streets to make sure that was protected. But when the people who depend on it the most are already marginalized populations that our society has shown they care less about, that's a risk people are willing to make a quick buck.
I do agree that part of the problem is that some of the native runs that the Lummies and others are trying to protect are endangered. So if you add a kind of invasive species or some other kind of exogenous element to that could really threaten and maybe wipe out one or two of the wild salmon runs. I mean, if these Atlantic salmon start eating too much of the food, if they start maybe transferring some disease, if they start eating the small fish, I mean, that's the fear, is that we haven't strengthened enough our native runs that these kinds of events can really do damage to them. And that's what the Lummi Nation and others are so fearful of.
Yeah, again, this release did not happen in a vacuum. For example, the state has been fighting for years against fixing its culvert problem on our highways that also threaten our native salmon runs. So again, this comes back to our consumption habits and whether we're being responsible about mitigating their impacts.
Am I being xenophobic again if I also note the freaky-looking nature of the
Their mouths
Atlantic.
Look really weird,
Well,
right?
some of them have. I think some of it is a genetic problem they have or something, but I don't know.
Maybe that's why they're
there is something weird about this Atlantic looking. I mean, it makes you want to eat wild. And if we had a robust wild population, we could.
They're not even pink, you know? They're not. You know how a salmon, it's like orangey, pinky, reddy, except the farm ones. My understanding is they're gray. They're fish pellet gray, and they dye them they color them for your shopping pleasure. Which makes them more expensive, too, I would think.
Yeah.
You're welcome. See, okay, the state's given the fish farm a month to clean up its mess, and the Indian tribes are saying the company ought to be fined for negligence and made to pay for all the cleanup costs. We'll watch that. It's KOW's Week in Review with Ijeoma Oluo, Sydney Brownstone, and C.R. Douglas. Right back in a moment. Okay, last topic maybe here on the Week in Review. Well, first of all, guess what? Seattle home prices rose again, up 13% in June from a year ago. Fastest increase in America for the 10th month in a row. We're booming. Some of that credit goes to one company, Amazon. And in fact, this week, the Seattle Times called Seattle America's biggest company town because more of our prime office space is controlled by a single company than any other major U.S. city. Amazon has more office space here than the next 40 biggest employers combined. Columnist Knut Berger at Crosscut says you don't want to be a company town.
One of the problems with having any one company be particularly strong is that eventually they will begin to rewrite the rules in their favor. They will begin to flex their muscle as they need to flex their muscle, and this often creates a real disproportionality of power.
Sydney, is that useful to call Seattle a company town?
Useful? Yeah, I think it can be useful. I think that when we don't have a diverse economy, we are in danger of subscribing to one company's rules and also one company's weaknesses. And in terms of big companies rewriting rules, we've already seen that with Boeing, right? Like getting a multi-billion dollar tax break and then laying off thousands of workers. So, I would agree with Knut's assertions there.
By the way, I'm not even nearly close enough to being an economist enough to know whether we have a diverse enough economy to survive what would you love it if Amazon just pulled out, relocated to Hong Kong, and our unaffordable real estate market finally crashed? Would that be a good thing?
No, I don't think anyone here would agree with that, right?
No. I mean, listen, there's upsides and downsides. I do agree with Knut that the more power you have, the more rule writing authority you get. But also, we're susceptible to a big downturn if a company is too strong. I mean, look at what happened to Boeing in the 70s. I mean, this town just shut down when Boeing did.
Well, that doesn't mean the company's too strong, does it? It just means that we don't have enough other...
I'm just saying, if you're not as diversified,
yeah,
We were all Boeing back in the 70s. Then when that company's fortunes go down, the town goes down.
Yeah.
So that's the threat here. If Amazon hits a stumble and, you know, Google and Facebook and the others sort of eat into their business and you have a real downturn, that would be a problem. You know, you saw that with Washington Mutual. I mean, Washington Mutual was the biggest downtown property leaseholder and owner right before the Great Recession. And we were hit hard downtown real estate when WaMu went under in that Great Recession. So there is a downside to be so dependent on one company.
Ijeoma, you're queen of the world. Amazon, which is helping drive up prices, stays or goes?
I was hoping you were just going to stop at queen of the world.
And period. Full stop. An author of the forthcoming book, So You Want to Talk About Race.
Ijeoma for mayor.
You know, I think that in all honesty, it's the question's a moot point. Amazon's not going anywhere.
Is this like the third time you've accused me of raising a moot point this hour? Fair enough.
I think that's my role.
Well, you are the queen.
My role is to just remind people that they're talking about the wrong things.
that's why we love you.
I think that if we were going to be having this conversation, we would have had this years ago, would have been the time to have it. I think the question now is, we are a company town, so now what does that look like? How do we make Amazon a responsible citizen of this state and this city? How do we make sure that people, everyone, is benefiting? And I think that's the biggest risk I see right now, is it's very easy to be comfortable and complacent because we have so much wealth and security that comes from Amazon. But we have to remember that only certain segments of the population are benefiting from it, and other people are further at risk because of it. And what we have to do, if we are in any way profiting from having Amazon here, and if Amazon is any way profiting from being here, we need to be reappropriating some of that profit to make sure that everyone here benefits. We have a company that's bringing a lot of people into the city to benefit, but we don't have a company that's necessarily making sure that everyone in the city benefits. And that's the city's job, and it's the state's job to make sure that we are doing what we can to ensure that people aren't left behind. I am more concerned about the people who are being left behind now than the people who may be harmed in the future if some disaster befalls Amazon. Right now, people are already missing out and are already being shoved out. And that is a responsibility that doesn't only lie on Amazon, but it does partially lie on Amazon, but also lies with our city.
Ijeoma Oluo is editor of The Establishment and queen of the world. C.R. Douglas, political analyst, Q13 News. Stranger reporter, Sydney Brownstone. I love each of you individually and collectively as a Weekend Review panel. Thank you.
It was fun. Thank you.
I'm Bill Radke. I'm Beside the Point, and I hope you'll come back and listen to us again next week. Happy Labor Day.